Welcome to the first episode of Bedtime Tea with Paula. I am so excited to finally branch out on my own and do my own podcast. It's something that I've put off for so long because I was afraid that I couldn't carry a podcast on my own, but I feel like it just needs to be done. You know, I have so much to say, so much to talk about, and it is something that I love to do. I really enjoy talking to you guys, and social media is great, but it doesn't provide the opportunity for longer conversations and for the nuance and complexity of the topics I like to talk about. So, welcome. If you don't know who I am, my name is Paula. I am a former early childhood educator turned toddler and baby sleep specialist. So I help families improve their sleep and their baby's sleep without sleep training. I am really passionate about responsive parenting, about conscious parenting. And for me, you know, some people will label me like an anti-sleep trainer. For me, really, I don't love sleep training. We'll get to that at some point. But it's not about ever shaming parents or making anybody feel like they've made a wrong choice. It's always about examining the systems. And that's what we're going to do on this podcast. We're going to talk about the bigger issues as how they affect parents. This isn't about pitting parents against each other. This is about looking at the conversation with nuance, with complexity, and just having a conversation about what are these systems causing and why is parenting so hard in this day and age. So that's a little bit of a gist of who I am and what you can expect here. There's going to be some sass. That's who I am. And yeah, that's pretty much it. At some point, I'm going to do a more in-depth episode on my story, my postpartum story, and how I got into what I got into. But I have a 3.5-year-old, and I am currently expecting my second baby. So this summer, I will have a 4-year-old and a newborn. So yeah, I'm excited. And I plan to continue doing this while I have my newborn. We'll see how it goes. But I think it'll be really interesting to take you guys on the journey of new parenthood the second time around with all the stuff I know now, which I'm super excited, honestly. I'm just so excited to get to do it over again and not listen to the BS that's out there. So yeah, I'm excited. All right, so without further ado, let's get into today's topic. So today we're talking about the snoo. Oh my goodness, this has been a topic. And you know what's crazy is I had actually planned to record this episode last week, and then I got COVID, which was super fun. And I wasn't able to record, but then all this stuff happened in between, and it's just giving us more context to what's going on. So let's just start from the beginning here. With the snoo. The snoo is a bassinet created by Dr. Harvey Karp. Dr. Harvey Karp is a famous pediatrician. He was a LA-based pediatrician, celebrity pediatrician, who wrote the book Happiest Baby on the Block back in the early 2000s, and it became a big sensation. He's the one who talks about the 5 S's to soothe your baby. And so he became really popular. Then he wrote Happiest Toddler on the Block. That became really popular. And then in 2019, I believe, he came out with the snoo, which is a bassinet. And basically what it does is it has a swaddle, a special swaddle that it comes with where you, you know, swaddle your baby arms in as you normally would, but it clips onto the mattress so that the baby is basically kind of attached to the bed and they are stuck on their back, like they can't move. And then the bassinet itself acts kind of like a robot, in that it senses if your baby cries or your baby wakes, and it rocks and soothes. It has like rocking motion, swaying, and it's got like sound. So it's got a bunch of stuff that will sort of attempt to soothe your baby for you when they wake in the middle of the night. And then there's a nap and all this stuff. So it is a very fancy smart bassinet that costs $1,700, of course. So, you know, it's interesting because, you know what, we'll get into that a little bit more. That's just the context of what the Snoo is. So at the end of March, the FDA announced approval for the Snoo. And I'm going to read this directly from the FDA news site. This is March 31st, this came out. On Thursday, the FDA authorized marketing for Happiest Baby Inc.'s Snoo Smart Sleeper, an over-the-counter infant sleep system. The Snoo Smart Sleeper bassinet plus the Snoo Sleep Sack are jointly intended to facilitate a supine position, laying flat on the back, during sleep for infants up to 6 months of age who are not yet able to roll over consistently. According to the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, infants who are placed in a supine sleep position are at a lower risk of sudden infant death syndrome or sudden unexpected infant death. As part of this device's evaluation, the FDA reviewed data comparing the incidence of reported SIDS, SUID, and Snoo users to historical CDC SIDS data. Although this data comparison was not sufficient to determine whether the device could prevent SIDS, the data did demonstrate the device did not increase or reduce the risk of SIDS. At this time, there are no infant sleep systems or infant positioners authorized for marketing by the FDA to prevent or reduce the risk of SIDS. The American Academy of Pediatrics and the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development recommend that the best way to reduce the chance of SIDS is to create a safe sleep environment for baby. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about safe sleep here for a minute. In the 90s, we had the Back to Sleep campaign. And prior to that, it was very, very common for people to put their babies on their belly to sleep. It was considered the best way to get your baby to fall asleep. And it makes sense because babies do tend to sleep deeper and better if they're on their belly just because it's more comfortable for them. But they have a higher chance of suffocating because they're not strong enough to hold their heads up, right? So they might suffocate against the mattress or anything that's on the crib. Or if they were to spit up, they could sort of inhale it back, right? So there's a few different issues with belly sleeping, and it was found through a lot of research that back sleeping is best. And they started the Back is Best campaign. You see it everywhere. There's even like sleep sacks that still say back is best. And so we saw a significant decrease in sudden infant deaths when this campaign came out. It was really, really helpful. So it is known that putting a newborn on their back is the best way to help prevent SIDS. Now, here's the thing. I'm going to go to the Safe to Sleep campaign. This is from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So they talk about reducing risks, and it does say, so place all babies, including those both born preterm, on their backs to sleep until they are 1 year old. It is not safe to put them on their sides or stomach, not even for a nap. Babies who sleep on their backs are at a lower risk of SIDS. And then it says, once babies can roll from back to stomach and from stomach to back on their own, you can leave them in the position they choose after starting sleep on their back. If they can roll only one way on their own, you can reposition them in their back. So the key here, and this is what you'll see in any public health recommendation, is that once a baby can roll on their own to their belly, it is fine to leave them in that position. There's rare occasions where a child, you know, is not, like, they roll by accident or something like that. That doesn't usually happen from back to belly unless the sleep environment isn't set up safely, which I'll talk about in a second. a lot of times I have parents tell me their infant has learned to roll and they find themselves on their tummy and they wake up and they cry for help because they don't like to be in that position. So if it is a problem, your child will usually let you know. And this is why it's so important to co-sleep, in the sense that your baby should be in your room for ideally the first year of life, because you need to be available to quickly respond to things like this, right? But as long as a baby is in a safe space and they roll to their belly on their own, your job is to place them on their back for every sleep up until a year old. Their job is to do whatever they're going to do after, right? Then they are safe. There is no data that I'm aware of, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but there's no data that shows that it's dangerous for a baby to sleep on their belly once they get there in that position. Now, the data that does exist, and the data that whoever's in charge of SNU PR has sent me. Okay, so I'm actually just going to go back a little bit. There was a post on the Happiest Baby website, Instagram page, sorry, that I left a comment on, and they responded to me with this canned response, but I'm going to read this to you. The AAP says babies should be placed on their back every night until they reach 1 year of age. The AAP emphasizes back sleeping for the first 12 months, well beyond the time when infants can roll consistently, because they want parents to know that even older babies are safer when they don't sleep on the stomach. Stomach sleeping has been shown to sometimes suppress a baby's central nervous system, breathing system. Attempts to roll occur as early as 2 to 3 months of age, well before babies have the motor ability to roll consistently. Babies who consistently roll during the day may be at high risk of SIDS if they roll prone at night while swaddled or in a bed containing bulky soft bedding, and they provide a reference for that. Also, babies who can consistently roll when awake may not be alert enough to roll off the stomach if in deep sleep. 10% of SIDS deaths, 350 a year, occur between 6 and 12 months of age, well beyond the age when they consistently roll. Okay, so this is really infuriating, because this is obviously written in a way that makes them sound really smart, like they know what they're talking about. We have references, we have research papers to back this up. But what they're saying makes no sense. First of all, they say babies who consistently roll during the day may be at high risk of SIDS if they roll prone at night while swaddled or in a bed containing bulky soft bedding. So, that is to say, you should not be swaddling your baby after 2 to 3 months of age, which is what the AAP says, right? If your baby's showing signs of rolling, they should not be in a swaddle. The other thing that the AAP also says is that they should be sleeping in a flat, firm surface, free of any, you know, stuffy, soft bedding, etc. So they're trying to make it sound like, well, if your baby rolls on their belly, they're gonna die. Well, no, because it's if they roll on their belly, and there's other unsafe factors that we know are unsafe factors that people need to be educated on. So it's just a very sneaky way of trying to say, like, our product is going to save you, when in reality, what's going to save people is proper sleep education, right? And then they say babies who can consistently roll when awake may not be alert enough to roll off their stomach if in deep sleep. And then what they are quoting here is that 10% of SIDS, so 10% of these unknown deaths that happen, are between 6 and 12 months of age. That's the data. Like, they're not saying, they haven't found that those babies have passed away because they rolled onto their belly. They have just found that those babies have passed away at 6 to 12 months of age, which basically shows you most SIDS deaths happen before 6 months. But that's it. That's all they're saying. That doesn't mean anything. That doesn't add to their point. So they're just kind of quoting evidence to make it sound like they know what they're talking about, but really it's like, let's look a little bit deeper into what you're saying, and you're not making any sense. Then they sent me another canned message about how amazing Dr. Harvey Karp is. And then Then again, they're quoting some research. So the risk of SIDS among babies who roll during sleep, even after they're old enough to consistently roll while awake, is confirmed by a study of babies who died while swaddled. Again, swaddled. So they say even after they're old enough to consistently roll while awake. So they're trying to scare you into saying, well, your baby can roll, but still they might die on their belly. Yeah, if they're swaddled, which you should not be doing. Out of a total of 22 infants, that's a pretty small number, 5 were 5 months or older, which is usually considered old enough to consistently roll. Again, that, okay, like, they're going by age even, like, they're not even saying they could roll, we don't know, right? Of great concern is that all 5 of these older babies were placed to sleep on their back but found on their stomach at their death scene. Again, and this is, by the way, I'm not minimizing how horrifying it is that babies are dying in their sleep. It is awful. And I don't even, like, I can't even imagine what that feels like. What's frustrating to me is that we're using this to fearmonger parents, and we're not quoting the right research. Like, we're like, he's just, they're just, they're trying to make it sound like rolling onto their belly is dangerous. But again, they're quoting research that says rolling onto their belly while swaddled is dangerous. Then they go on, the 2022 AAP technical report on SIDS noted, although it may be more likely that parents will initially place a swaddled infant supine, this protective effect may be offset by the 12-fold increased risk for SIDS if the infant is either placed or rolls on the prone position when swaddled. Again, swaddled. Their second thing, it says, the 2022 AAP technical report on SIDS noted one study analyzing sleep-related deaths reported to state child death review teams found that the predominant risk factor for sleep-related deaths in infants 4 to 12 months of age was rolling into objects in the sleep area. So again, into loose bedding, lovies, whatever, right? And again, that is Safe Sleep 101. Do not put lovies, do not put soft bedding in the crib with your baby. So, And what they found, what the SNU found in the FDA approval that we just talked about, is that it doesn't increase SIDS, having a baby in the SNU, but it doesn't decrease it either. But that's not what they're trying to make it sound like, and that is why I'm so frustrated by this, because they're being extremely, extremely sneaky. And if you don't believe me, it gets worse. Now, one other thing I looked into was there was a Business Insider article written back in February about sort of the inside look at the people who work at Happiest Baby. And they interviewed 12 former employees who basically talked about a really terrible work environment and culture. I'm not even really going to get into that today just because that's not confirmed, right? Like, they are, I mean, I trust that Business Insider is doing their job vetting who they're interviewing, but still, it is claims by former employees. We can't say everything for sure, but that I will link that if you guys want to read it. But here's something that is incredibly frustrating to me, and this is a quote from CARP. When this new debuted, he says, new parent exhaustion is a national emergency. Sleep deprivation triggers marital stress, postpartum depression, abuse, obesity, accidents, and infant sleep deaths. That is why I feel so dedicated to developing this new way to help babies and tired parents sleep better. Again, he's giving white savior vibes, and that is what I find incredibly frustrating. You are making a very expensive device and you are sending it to celebrities. Like, this is a luxury product, and that's fine. That is absolutely fine if you want to make a product, as long as it's safe, that helps people who can afford it, which is not a lot. Just don't make claims that you're, like, saving the world. That is what is incredibly frustrating to me. And then just saying sleep deprivation triggers marital stress, postpartum depression, abuse, obesity. What? Now, Now we're adding fat phobia into this equation. Accidents and infant sleep death, you know. And here's the thing, new parent exhaustion is an emergency. It is a problem. What we need, though, is not an expensive robot to care for our baby. What we need is parental leave, support, right? Like, we need a village of support. And he seems to understand this, which I'll get to again, but it's just really frustrating that he's using these things that are real issues to sell an overpriced machine. Now, here's where it gets even more icky. So somebody forwarded me this email, which went out to the Happiest Baby mailing list. And it's a message from our founder, Dr. Harvey Karp. Okay, so it reads, "Hi, I'm thrilled to share some happy and pretty historic news. Snoo is the first and only baby-led granted de novo, the only baby bed granted de novo approval by the US FDA for keeping babies safely on their back. As a pediatrician, I have been haunted by the fact that every year, 3,500 healthy babies die in their sleep, and that tragic number has not budged in over 20 years. By the way, that is true. The rate of SIDS hasn't particularly decreased. We saw a significant decrease with the Back to Sleep campaign in the 90s, and then since then it's sort of stayed stagnant. We don't really, and here's the thing, right? When you're talking about SIDS, and we're going to get into that a little bit more. We need to get into that in more detail. I'm going to have at some point Candace, my great friend Candace, who is a public health professional. She unfortunately couldn't be with us for this episode because she is off to the Bahamas, lucky girl, to talk about the difference between SIDS and SUIDS and all of that. But yes, the risk of SIDS or the rate of SIDS has not decreased in 20 years. So that's important. He goes on. All doctors recommend parents always place babies on their back to sleep. Nevertheless, in most cases of infant sleep deaths, the baby is found on their side or stomach. Snoo is so safe because of its award-winning swaddle that clips into the bed to secure babies on their back and prevent risky rolling. Do all babies need to be secured on the back? Think of it this way. Today, no parent would drive their infant even for 3 minutes without securing them in a car seat. The most common place infants die is in bed, yet we routinely place them in the crib or bassinet for 12 to 14 hours per day, totally unsecured. Just as infant car seats have dramatically improved child car safety, I hope that Snoo will revolutionize our understanding of infant sleep safety. If you have already trusted Snoo with your precious little one, thank you for welcoming us into your home. It is a privilege to enter your lives at such a tender time, and I hope that Snoo helps you get much-needed rest and peace of mind and good health, Harvey." Okay, did you guys catch that? Do all babies need to be secured on their back? Well, think of it this way. Today, no parent would drive their... He is comparing strapping a baby to their bed to strapping them into a car seat. He's basically claiming that, like, this is the new thing. This is what we need to do to prevent SIDS, is we need to be strapping babies to their bed because we strap them to a car seat. Okay, here's the big difference. You're not going 70 miles per hour in your bed. Like, that is just a ridiculous, ridiculous point. And what scares me about this type of messaging, he doesn't outwardly come out. Like, he phrases it in a very subtle way. But it's basically saying we should be strapping babies to their back to prevent them from rolling. And what this is going to do is this is going to cause parents to think that that is what they need to be doing and to come up with unsafe solutions to strap their babies onto their back. Now, here's the thing. With the Snoo, I understand why the baby needs to be strapped, because the baby is being rocked and swayed in the crib, right? The crib is moving. So yeah, I actually think it's a good idea to strap them down, because if you're gonna rock the crib, the baby has a chance of rolling. So that's a specific environment. But in a regular sleeping environment in a regular crib that is set up safely as it's supposed to, there's no reason to strap your baby down to their backs. Again, I don't have an issue with the snoo if you want to use it and it works for you. It's been proven not to be unsafe. But he is trying to make it sound like he has found the answer to SIDS, and he has not. He has not, because kids still die in their cribs, on their backs, if you do all the right things, because we don't truly know the cause of SIDS, right? Sudden infant death syndrome. It is not always known. There was a study last year that came out, I believe, that they had found some sort of genetic marker that they believe had to do with white babies die. Again, we don't know for sure. That is still really preliminary. We know that sometimes babies don't make it. They just stop breathing and we don't exactly know why. There are babies who suffocate and, you know, again, because they roll into something that they're not supposed to, and why we have all these safe sleep guidelines. But outside of that, we don't need to be coming up with arbitrary ways to hold our babies on their back and restrain them. That is outrageously unnecessary. The other thing is that we are seeing a lot of physical therapists and occupational therapists come out against the snoo for the reason of it keeping babies restrained, and what they're advertising it for is to keep your baby in there for 6 months. That is a very long time to keep your baby swaddled at night. Most kids are rolling before 6 months. And their nighttime movement is important. It is just as important as their daytime movement. And so it's not a great idea to restrain them for that long. I am going to have an interview later in this episode with Dr. Bonnie, who is a physical therapist, and she's going to talk a little bit more about that and what the concerns are with that. Now, there are people who use the snoo in different ways. I have known lots of clients who are like, we didn't actually use it with all its features. Maybe we didn't use the swaddle. We actually just used the sound and not the rocking motion, or we still responded even though the thing tried to soothe the baby. Like, people try their own different things. And it's really important to me to say, yet again, I do not have an issue with people buying it and using it. I am concerned, again, about what the company is presenting, that A, it is necessary to keep babies strapped to their back, and B, that it is a good idea to swaddle for that long, because the reality is the AAP says right now what it says on their website is 3 to 4 months. I have read before it's 8 months. 8 weeks. I don't know when that changed exactly, but you should not be swaddling until 6 months. It is just not a good idea for their development. Again, we're going to talk about that, but that is my concern. It is that they are presenting things that could potentially be dangerous, right? Yes, the baby isn't going to die if they use the snoo, but what other concerns are we causing? And at the end of the day, this isn't going to work for every parent, which is another concern that I have. So to talk about that and to talk about the concerns with extended swaddling, I have an interview for you with Dr. Bonnie Soto. She is a pediatric physical therapist. She is on Instagram at milestone_mama or on TikTok at milestonemama. She's amazing, and we had an amazing conversation about the snoo. So without further ado, let's get into that. Okay, so today I have a very special guest. Why don't you tell us who you are and what your background is?
Sure.
I'll let you introduce yourself.
My name is Bonnie Soto. I'm a pediatric physical therapist. I've been practicing for about, over 10 years now, solely in pediatrics.
Yeah.
That's me. Amazing.
Yeah, I love that. And can you, and I know this could probably be a really long answer, but can you give people a bit of a overview of what physical therapy, specifically pediatric physical therapy, covers? Because I think
Yeah.
A lot of people think it's a little bit more maybe dramatic than it is. Like, like you have to be like really bad to go to, do you know what I mean? Yeah. So could you give us some ideas of what you work on a daily basis?
Yeah. So it can vary for everyone who practices, even in pediatrics, what it is that you do. We certainly in general cover from birth up to like 18 to 21. Okay. And yes, it can be for more like pronounced, you know, big diagnoses like brain injury, cerebral palsy, you know, spina bifida,
right,
those types of things. But certainly we see babies for other issues, toddlers, children who have, you know, more vague things going on. So even just like low muscle tone, or we mm-hmm. see, you know, I specifically see lots of younger children. So babies who have torticollis or plagiocephaly, which is that flat head shape. You even see babies who have just like excess muscle tension, just having a hard time moving. Maybe there's mm-hmm. no diagnosis, but you know, baby's not hitting their skills or their milestones on time. Some therapists, you know, work closely with lactation consultants and feeding providers to help mm-hmm. work through those issues as well. Basically, our job is to help a child, a baby, toddler, whatever age, move better so that they can explore their environment, interact with friends, family, caregivers, whatever that means to them. So that, you know, it really does cover a lot of different things.
Yeah.
There's a lot that we can do with even just our specialty.
Yeah. I love that. And it's so, so important because we don't take that into account nearly enough, I think.
Especially when it comes to babies, I think that we kind of dismiss their movement needs.
Yes.
Which is why we're here today talking.
It's why we're here today. I know. It's one of those things that like, it's not known enough. I mean, I'll start with like a bit of a personal anecdote. Like my son was born holding his head up and he was very, very strong is what my thought was. And he was like 9 days old when he rolled over for the first time. And I'm like, my kid is a genius. And then I learned later on that is a sign of tension. And he was very tense. He had a tongue tie and all that stuff. So, do you see that a lot?
Yes. Yeah. That's a really common misconception. And I also personally had a baby like
that
too. Yeah.
Yes. You're like, my baby's so strong. Well, you knew better.
Yeah. Well, it was a whole learning journey for me too. I mean, I certainly knew that like the early rolling is a sign of, okay, stiffness. But at that time, I really didn't know, because this isn't something that's taught in school. This is something that you have to go on your own personal learning journey with. Right. So my first child taught me a lot too, is like, what does that tension mean? How can it affect feeding journeys? How can it affect milestones? How is it related to ties and all of that, that encompasses it. That's not general knowledge, even for those of us that have studied infant development. And so, yeah, that's a big area of education. Yeah.
It's frustrating because I find myself, you know, often referring people out to people like yourself or other professionals because of these issues, because they affect sleep. And there's so many people who come back and be like, oh yeah, my doctor told me that's a fad. My doctor told me that's BS. Oh, they just haven't learned to self-soothe. Which is that one infuriates me the most. But even frustrating when they'll go to like a physical therapist who tells them, oh yeah, they're fine, they look perfect. And it's like, no, we can tell there's something going on, but not every physical therapist is trained in that. And you know, as a parent, you feel like you're crazy, because if the professionals are telling you everything's fine, why would I continue to believe there's something wrong? And that's just really, I mean, it just being in that position as a parent, it's the worst feeling ever.
And it's exhausting. And, you know, I think a lot of families don't know, or maybe don't even have the energy if they've already sought more support and they're being told it's fine, they don't know to maybe get a second opinion from somebody who is more specialized in that area, because it's not common knowledge. And again, it's exhausting. And I think you hit a certain point as a parent, you know, if you're on this long journey, especially in those early days, that you're like, I just get, you know, it's just like, I give up.
Or you feel like, you feel like you are just literally losing your mind. Like you are just thinking like, I'm just being a hypochondriac. Like I'm just overthinking it, you know, and people will, especially as a new parent, as a brand new parent, people will be like, oh, first time parent, you're just too worried. You're fine. And it's like, I feel that anxiety for my clients so much all the time because usually there's something and they just, you know, and so it's that fine line if you don't want to be that overly stressed out parent. And also you want to catch things that you could do to support your child. So that isn't mama to scare
gut.
People.
That mama gut never like steers you wrong.
It really doesn't. It really doesn't. And I think that is a really good point on what we're going to talk about today because let's get into it. So I've been talking in the podcast, I've been talking about the whole situation with the snoo and what it is and how it's being presented as a life-saving device. And one of the things that's come up, and I was hoping you'd speak to, is there are concerns in terms of if you use it as they intend for you to use it, aka swaddling your baby, strap them to the bed until 6 months. Mm-hmm. What are we concerned about here? Is it just perfectly safe? You know, do that and your baby will be fine. I know that's kind of really open-ended, but you can get us started with your initial thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of concerns about that. I could go in so many different directions. Yeah. I guess I'll start like
Let's start with swaddling, I guess. Yeah. Like just swaddling in general. What are your feelings about swaddling?
Yeah. So in general, swaddling is a tool, right? It's a tool that helps us it helps baby transition from that like cramped, comfy, cozy, warm intrauterine space to the outside world where we are expecting them to sleep on their backs on a firm surface. I mean, you can see that drastic difference there.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of babies do somewhat like it, at least in those first few days, and that's okay. The issue in my mind is with that, I would consider 6 months to be prolonged swaddling. And so it's containment. It's keeping them from moving. And so do we really want to keep them from moving in their sleep?
For that long.
For that long.
Would you say, what's your sort of, if you were to recommend to someone who is like, who does like the swaddle, when do you want them to start transitioning out of it?
Yeah. So the general recommendation is when they start showing signs of rolling, but I feel like that's where the recommendation stops. Nobody talks about what is that?
What does that look like?
And so, you know, when your baby starts to show signs of rolling, it usually looks like they're flexing their legs up in the air. They're grabbing feet. They're probably rolling to their sides. Okay. They're like reaching off to the sides, looking off to the sides. That can happen pretty early. I mean, some babies start even rolling to their sides as early as 8 weeks, maybe 12 weeks. I've definitely seen babies roll over onto their bellies. So I typically counsel my families to start thinking about weaning from day one so that baby can be weaned out by 8 to 12 weeks. It is a process. It's not something that you get to 8 weeks and you go, oh, I got to wean you with a swaddle now.
Some people do because they find themselves, oh crap, my kid rolled and I have to cold turkey get off the swaddle. And it's just so much harder than if you give yourself the time to do it a little slowly, if you can. Right. I think 8 weeks, you know, I posted about this the other day and I haven't been able to find, I feel like the AAP was saying 8 weeks at some point and that's changed.
I think that when they updated their, cause I was looking this up. I think that when they updated their guidelines last year, I think that's when it changed because I remember very specifically like earlier in my career being like the AAP says 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And I even remember as a new mom, like being like, oh my gosh, like, wow, this seems so early now. But But I think that they changed it, and now it just says when baby starts showing signs of rolling. But then
it
doesn't
says or 3 to 4 months.
Oh, okay. So it says or 3 to 4 months, which 4 months to me is like, that's late. I think that's too late.
I think so too. And I think the issue is, again, with it, it's not an easy process, especially if your child has been on it for a long time.
Yeah.
And if you're entering, let's like, which is very common, is kids go through that 4 month regression. Now you're, you know, you're like going through hell because
it's
now you're
trying.
Yeah. And it's so much harder. So, okay. So we know, and I've ranted about this, that the reason for, you know, safety wise, we don't want a baby rolling onto their belly in a swaddle. That's just not a good idea. They don't, you know, it's not safe. They have a chance of suffocating.
Yep.
So that's a big reason why we want to move them off the swaddle. But is there other reasons from your perspective that we don't want to swaddle them for that long?
Yeah, for sure. So I was kind of touching on earlier, just movement in general, right? Mm-hmm. It restricts movement. And where does that become a concern? One big area is this whole talk of, and I'm sure people have heard people in pediatric PTs talking about torticollis and plagiocephaly.
Yeah.
And so real quick, you know, torticollis is when there's tightness in the neck muscles. Usually that correlates with some tightness throughout the body as well. And so if we have tension and tightness in the body, and then we're continuing to restrict movement, it's going to just build on each other. Mm-hmm. And so along with that, if baby is tight and their head's always turned one way, they're always putting pressure on that back part of their head. That's where the plagiocephaly happens. It's that prolonged pressure mm-hmm. on the back of the head. So if we're swaddling, mm-hmm. we're restricting movement, baby's not going to explore turning their head to the other side even more so than they might have before mm-hmm. because their body is restricted.
Yeah.
A baby's movement, like their head and their body, basically it's all moving together. And so if their body's restricted, their head and neck movement is restricted too. So typically that swaddling can lead to more severe torticollis, more severe plagiocephaly, which means that family is going to have to go to therapy now. Wonderful. And that can be a pretty lengthy process to deal with that. Appointments can happen for months on end. Sometimes those babies need cranial remodeling helmets. Yeah. That's a huge cost and another stressor placed on the family as well. It's not an easy process, I will say that. So that's difficult. And then I was just touching on like just movement in general. We want to be able to move in our sleep.
Yeah.
We don't move in our sleep. It's for comfort purposes. And babies are no different.
Yeah. Sorry, I want to go back a little bit though for the torticollis and the plagiocephaly. Yep. I just want to sort of clarify for people. Mm-hmm. Can it happen even if a baby isn't spending I want to make sure like people know that it's not necessarily that it's their fault if their baby has these issues.
So that's a really good point.
Yeah, I don't want to scare people.
Yeah, I don't want to scare people either. Thank you. Sorry. Sometimes I get so excited about what I'm talking about.
I hear you.
On this tangent. So anyway, I think it's pretty under-recognized how many babies are potentially born with asymmetries and movement preferences that go undiagnosed for the first few months of life.
Yeah.
Until all of a sudden it's a very obvious issue. Like, whoa, okay, now we see this flathead. Mm-hmm.
You're only rolling one way. How come?
You're only rolling one way. Yeah, that's when it becomes more obvious to a more untrained eye. Mm-hmm. So it's not it's not like the swaddling is causing it necessarily. I think we know that it happens from intrauterine positioning. It can happen from just the birth process in general, and then just being a newborn in a back to sleep world and our world where we do need, we rely on containers, as part of our village, basically.
Yeah.
Those things all increase the likelihood. And then you know, there are other risk factors too for like, you know, if it's your first child, if there are, you have multiples, those all increase the likelihood that you might have a baby with torticollis and plagiocephaly. My first had torticollis.
So, did she? Okay.
You know, it's like, I'm a pediatric PT and I do this every day and I still...
Yeah, I mean, I just had a, I was just working with a client who had a little girl had a helmet for the plagiocephaly, and she, I mean, is a very, you know, never like very responsive parent, like lots of contact naps, lots of holding baby up. So it's not like she spent like all the time on her back and that's why it happened, you know? So I just want to caution people of that because, you know, it's not, we're not saying that that is the cause. We're just saying that it could aggravate those issues, and it's just, yeah, we want our kids to woo. And you know, getting back to that other piece of it, now I have a question because I've heard this before and I feel like, I don't know if it's well studied or there seems to be some debate out there about integrating that moral reflex. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me about that a bit more?
Yeah, so that startle, you'll hear people call it startle or the moral reflex. That's, you know, when baby has some kind of, you know, stimulus, often it's like an auditory stimulus, but any kind of stimulus that makes them, you know, spread their wings out, their arms out, and they kind of like startle awake. So we integrate that through movement. So being able to move around. And so the swaddle can, that's the point of it, right? Is to dampen that startle reflex. So baby potentially is sleeping longer periods of time. They're not waking themselves up by letting those arms fling out. But they do need to have that experience in order to rewire those motor pathways. That is an important piece of the puzzle here. So whether you allow them to do that early on or whether you decide to stop swaddling a little bit later, they're still going to have to go through that experience, which typically does mean that they're going to have, you know, few days of being more wakeful and having a hard time. But what they have to experience is, oh, there was the dog barking and I startled, but you know what, I'm still in a safe environment, or you know, my person came to snuggle me, and so I can rewire that pathway after lots of repetitions of it to say, okay, I'm safe. I don't need to startle to that stimulus and over and over again. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And that's, you know, it adds up why we don't want to wait so long, because we don't want them to take, because again, it like you said, it's that double whammy, right? Like sleep can only get more difficult as they get older and there's a million other things going on. And now we have to integrate these reflexes and, you know, there's just all of that happening. And I don't know if you see this, you know, I obviously I talk to people specifically about sleep, but in my experience, when kids are learning any big milestones, like rolling, crawling, whatever, they are going to be more wakeful. Especially I find those kids who are a little bit earlier on those milestones, it tends to sort of affect them more. I don't know. This has always been my theory. You're nodding. So I'm glad I'm not crazy. Yeah. Do you find that's the case?
I feel like, well, first, definitely lots of, you know, motor skills impact sleep, especially when you get to those skills that, you know, babies like getting up into all fours and then they're like, wait, what the heck? How did I get here? How do I get out of it?
Yeah.
I think that really impacts them, especially if they're hitting it early, because sometimes they learn how to get into it, but they haven't practiced how to get out of it. Like, I'm in sitting, how did I get here? What do I do now?
Or they're just, like,
cognitively, they're like,
it seems like they're excited. My son crawled in his sleep for, I kid you not, a good month. Like he would just crawl and hit his head on the side of the crib. Like it was just wild. And I was like, what are you doing, kid? Go back to sleep. But he just, it was like, I can crawl. Like, it was so wild.
So exciting for them that they can like explore their environment. They want to do it, whether it's in their bed or it's, you know, out in the living room.
Right. And that's kind of, and that's the thing, we're meant to move, right? Like we're, you know, we're not meant to be kind of strapped to our back and babies sleep for a long time, right? Like they sleep more of their day than they're awake. And so we're leaving them strapped in all the time.
Right. Yeah. They sleep for long, you know, periods, whether or not, you know, you want to think it in those. Overall.
Wakeful, but.
Periods. Yeah. And that's a long time for them to be, you know, in one position and not even able to move for comfort purposes. I mean, it might not be a big movement, you know, they could just kind of weight shift over to the other side, but that means, oh, I'm turning my head to that side too and taking the pressure off of my soft skull. They have these soft skulls, and that's why we see those flat head issues and those movement asymmetries. You know, it could be just those little movements, but those little movements are a big deal in the early months. They don't seem like maybe a big deal to some people, but there's a lot happening there that's teaching them how to reach with their arms. That's teaching them how to roll to their side, roll
it's
to their
so
belly.
Amazing.
It's, yeah, it is amazing. There's so many little things happening that are such a big foundational piece to all the big things that we tend to appreciate a little bit more later on.
Yeah.
They're dependent on us for all positioning. And, you know, that's a big deal early on. Like they can't roll over and reposition. They can only do those little weight shifts and squirms, but that's why those are such a big deal at that age. They need us for everything, which is why they cry out for us at night, you know, because I'm uncomfortable. I want my person to reposition me, you know? And so that's really important until they can do that themselves. Oh, and we want them doing that themselves daytime and nighttime.
Yeah. So have you in your practice seen folks who have maybe used the SNU and you experienced those concerns that you have?
Yeah. I can remember several specific scenarios because, and this was like back in the day before I even had kids of my own, I did not even know what the SNU was. Mm. I was not consistently asking about where baby was sleeping. Mm. And I remember a few children, it wasn't until I was probably like 4 or 5 sessions in with these kiddos, and I wasn't seeing the progress that I had typically seen. The presentation of the torticollis and the head shape was much more severe. And I'm like, okay, you know, there's something else going on here that I'm not getting to the bottom of. Like, so I'm asking the parents more questions. And I think in one of the cases just casually brought up like, oh yeah, you know, at night we're using the SNU. And I had a whole conversation. The parents
what is that?
About what it was. I didn't even know.
Yeah.
And so once I started asking more about it and like really specifically asking families, like, where is baby sleeping? I did, you know, certainly anecdotally, but I have seen that these babies have more severe presentations. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, like you said, it is anecdotal. We don't have the evidence, but this is the frustrating thing, right? Like the FDA approving something, it just means we're not seeing more babies die.
Right.
You know, great, but that's not all there is to child development and health. I mean, great, we don't want more baby, and so and you know, and I've pointed this out already, but we're not seeing more babies, like we're also not seeing less babies die, right? So it doesn't change the risk of
sickness. I that's what is upsetting to me is, you know, the FDA approval is, you know, we have a device that keeps babies on their back, but the general public just sees it was FDA approved and now I need this for my baby, and we're not considering, or maybe just, you know, we don't have enough information out there about all of the other things to consider about it, not just do I need this for safety, but what about my child's development and all of those other pieces that are not being talked about from a marketing perspective. As a pediatric PT, so I can say pretty comfortably that babies that are rolling to their stomachs are babies that are doing well with tummy time.
Right.
Babies do not, in general, roll to their sides or their stomachs unless they like playing in those positions. Very often I'll get families coming in and they'll be like, I don't know what's going on. My baby is not rolling. You know, what do we do? And my first question is always, how's tummy time going? Yeah. And the answer is usually not so well. And it's like, well, of course, why, you know, there are other factors to consider here, of course, but overall it's like, okay, well, I wouldn't want to roll to my belly either if I don't like being there. There's a reason for that we have to explore.
Yeah. Well, and I, to be fair, I have met a lot of people who say their baby has learned to roll to their tummy and they'll be upset because they find themselves in their tummy at nighttime and sure. they have to come roll them back because they're upset, not because they're like worried. And I always kind of say, unfortunately, it's kind of one of those things you kind of have to write it out and practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I usually, you know, tell them, you know, be very sort of compassionate, but also confident and just show them how to roll back and they'll yeah. eventually get the hang of it. Cause they usually learn that first, right? Is that correct?
Yeah. Usually. I think that the component to that too is like it's startling. I think that yeah. they might be, you know, they're literally rolling in their sleep and then they because
where am I?
That sensation. Yeah, yeah, it's a totally different like vestibular experience. They're not used to that sensation in their sleep, so it does wake them up, and they kind of just forget for a while. Yeah. Even when they're awake, they kind of forget, like in air quotes, for a while how to roll back because yeah. there are other skills happening that can kind of block that. So yeah. it startles them, it makes them upset, and so but still typically those kids are doing well in tummy time. And so yeah. my point with that, I guess, is they can lift their head up really well. They can
yeah that's my thought, like they're strong enough
airway. Yeah, so yeah. as long as that sleep environment is safe,
yeah,
we're good from that perspective. So
absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely.
You know, we, as long as we have those arms out, we're ready to push up and turn and clear, we're good.
Do we have any concerns about the rocking and the swaying, like the artificial rocking and swaying?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I've definitely seen some occupational therapists comment on this too.
Okay,
that whole sensory perspective of mm-hmm. them being responded to by that, you know, that same movement pattern versus a caregiver movement yeah. pattern, you know, that response of where we can kind of modify and change yeah. position. And then I think just overall, like how that affects the cueing between the caregiver and the child as well. I think that's a concern when it comes yeah. to that automatic rocking.
It is. And it, you know, that's one of the frustrating things because in an interview with Dr. Karp, he was saying, well, you know, parents say that it's better for that because they know if their baby doesn't settle with the stew, then they're truly hungry or they're truly, but it's like, there's so many other reasons why kids wake up and, you know.
Yeah. And how did they, that confuses me. I'm like, how do they know? Just because they don't settle to this motion, they're no. truly hungry? Or yeah, are they seeking just closeness yeah. with their caregiver? I mean, is it that and hunger? I mean, there's so there's many pieces to this. Yeah. I get frustrated with this oversimplification of who a baby is.
Yeah.
I mean, babies are humans. They're not these tiny little robots. They yeah. have complex needs just like we do.
Yeah, and that's a frustrating thing. And I mean, like, I know you're not an OT, but you know, it's all very kind of related. But
yes.
for me, I am very, very sensitive to vestibular input. And I still to this day cannot go on the swings with my son because I get nauseous. And so for me, the thought of something rocking me in the middle of the night, like I literally want to barf at the thought of that. And I'm just like, I'm literally thinking, if I was a baby and I wake up and I'm crying and this thing starts rocking me, I'm probably going to shut up because I want it to stop.
Yeah, true.
Like, you know right? what I mean? That's me, right? And that I'm not saying that's all babies. I'm just saying like, I wouldn't enjoy that. That wouldn't be soothing to me. But how would you know? Because you're not a human that's responding to this child. It's a robot. Right. Like it's right. just, and again, and I've said this so many times, I don't have an issue with people using the tools that are available to them. It's just like, we need to just be conscious about what it could be potentially doing, how it could be potentially changing our responsiveness to our child and all that right. stuff. And,
yeah.
and then the other issue is then of course you get to the point where, what happens after 6 months? Your right. SOL.
Oh yeah, right. That's I'm sure. I mean, I've heard from families that's you know can be a really difficult journey for them. What do you do? I mean that infant still is going to wake up potentially at 7 and 8 months, and you still have to respond to them. And so you know it's
And now they're used to this.
They're used
thing.
To that. Uh-huh. Yep. Yeah.
So I've had that. It has been a thing that people have struggled with getting off the snoo. And yeah, and it's tough. And I mean, this is where, you know, that's the time when you get sold sleep training, right? And so then that's what we do. And so then people say, well, how do you manage without sleep training? And it's like, yeah, well, there's all these other things that we're kind of being conscious of too. It's not just you just decide at 6 months that you're not going to sleep train your baby, but
I think, you know, that whole process is just an oversimplification of like the needs of the baby and this relationship that you're creating. Like, you know, that baby still has needs and we have needs too. And that's so valid.
Oh my
but
God. Yeah.
The point where this breaks apart is that I think we're being sold this idea that to tend to our needs, our baby has to do sleep this certain way when there are so many other ways that we can tend to our needs. And this is a whole other conversation, but you know,
story
there's
of
so
my
many
life.
Other ways that we can be educated, like on the general public, of like ways that we can also tend to our needs without having to buy a $1,700 bassinet or go sleep training route and all of that stuff. There are so many other ways that we can go about this process.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's what makes my heart hurt the most, because I just...
Thank you
for saying the whole thing.
Thing. And that's my big thing. And he, you know, again in the interviews, he talks about sort of it's very interesting because he's very sort of aware that we lack a village in our culture.
Sure.
But then he's trying to say that this is sort of because he's like, well, you know, the mother wouldn't always be holding the baby; it would be the grandmother or the sister. And it's like, yeah, that's still a human. Like, that's different than a robot. And again, we get it, right? Like, I get it. People don't have that village. And obviously that's what we're fighting for. But to just claim that this AI could possibly be the same as a human who is responding to a child and having this back and forth conversation and feedback and, you know, like, oh, you're uncomfortable. Hold on. Let me move this way. Or, oh, you know, like it's different. It is so different.
Yeah. Let me change your position. Let me move in a different way. Let me sing you a song. Let me go into a different room. I mean, think about all
you
of
you can
the
feel my heartbeat. You can feel my warmth. Like,
Like,
that's just so not the same.
It's not.
Yeah.
From a relationship perspective, from a movement. I mean, if I'm just thinking with my PT brain on, it's so different. And we've touched on that, like that sensory system perspective and all of those pieces are part of infant development, infant mental health. I mean, it's huge.
I mean, I love that. I think you touched on all the things I wanted to chat about. I guess I have one more question for you. This isn't a swaddling episode, but you know, I'm expecting. So this is a personal question.
I love it.
How do you feel about the like arms up swaddle things?
The big thing that I'm thinking about with swaddling is in a ideal situation, I do still want baby to have access to their hands somehow.
Okay.
And so, you know, in an ideal world, I would love for baby to have their hands swaddled close to their face so that they can do some of that hands to mouth situation. That isn't always what works best for a baby. And so, you know, some families do find that they have a better response in those arms up swaddles. For me, it is the same overarching idea of we want to still get the baby time. We're not like, you know, we're not like completely restricting movement, but maybe if we're using that at night because that helps us at nighttime, then what can we do during the day? Like, can you have some swaddle free naps? Can you have some contact naps on your chest? What? And you know, can you have naps in the carrier on your body? Just giving some varying situations.
Fair.
And then trying short bouts of, you know, out of that swaddle as you're able to. So you're thinking again about swaddling, I mean, weaning from swaddling from day one. You know, you're just trying little bits here and there to get baby's response to it. You know, it might not be ideal developmentally, but overall, right.
You can still use the tools.
Varying experiences. Yeah.
I mean, that's how I felt with Baisan. I never liked the idea of swaddling. And so we weren't thinking about swaddling, and then we had him, and I, you know, was under this idea of like, he needs to sleep in his crib on his own. And he was Starling. So we tried a million swaddles. We bought like the Velcro ones and the other one, and he got out of everything. He really wanted those hands by his face. And yeah. Like you said, yeah. And so we found that there's like the pouch ones. So there's like the ergo pouch where it's like, mm-hmm. you know, they're like zipped in, but they still kind of have some movement of their arms. Mm-hmm. So he was able to still get his hands kind of like by his neck. Those ones worked well, or the arms up one. So he really liked to sleep in that position. Yeah. And so we did that for a bit, and then we did wean him off pretty early. I don't remember exactly when, but I'm just, you know, I was just wondering, because to me that felt like a bit of a compromise of like, okay, you're not swaddle tight, because he didn't like that. Like, he was just like getting out of that no matter how hard we tried.
Yeah, so. And that's a good, you know, that was like really good, you know, following his cues and saying, okay, that is not working for you. Mm-hmm. How can I compromise? Because you're right, there are so many options out there on the market. It's kind of confusing. Like, which one do I need? And oftentimes you don't know until you have your baby.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Spend, like, you know, money buying.
Pro tip for new parents, don't buy all the things before your baby. Like, get people to give you some Amazon gift cards, yes. Like Carter's or whatever, like local baby shop you have, because you're going to do a few trips to get the random stuff you didn't think you needed.
Yep.
What we definitely didn't need was all the mittens that we got.
Yes. And I, not a fan of the mittens. Yeah. Not a fan. We want those hands out. We want them out.
Or the hats, really. Like, I didn't use any hats. I had most of them were like hand-me-downs, but I had hats and mittens that we never, I mean, he was a summer baby too, but never. We
right,
never
if you're going them. Out, but like, yeah, you don't need that stuff. I know we didn't ever use hats either, so.
Yeah.
We want that skin free and feeling the environment.
Yeah, the sensory input, right?
It is.
Of course, keeping those claws nice and trimmed.
They
do come out with
claws. I know that's why everybody likes to use the mittens, but
yeah. So thank you so much for that. I really appreciate your time coming in and talking about this. And and where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram and TikTok, Milestone Mama. On Instagram, it's Milestone_Mama.
Okay. Gotcha. No, that's awesome. You share some really good information, and I loved that you had a rant about this too. So I was like, oh gosh, we need to talk about this.
Yeah, I know. And I feel like we could talk forever about it too. There's so many facets to it, but yes.
There is. And I said to you before, I probably will ask you to come back to talk about something else when that comes up. But I, you know, we wanted to keep this on this topic. So thank you again for your time. And we'll say bye to everybody. Bye guys. Bye.
Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with Bonnie. She's amazing. And I found that very educational myself. So for this episode, I'm going to leave it there. I have a lot to say about this topic, but we're an hour in and I don't want to bore you guys forever. What I want you to do though is check in. You can find me on Instagram at Paula Morales McDowell. Yes, it is a bit of a mouthful. Yes, it will be linked in the show notes. And tell me what you want to hear about next. What topics should I cover? What guests should I have on? What should we talk about? And of course, if you enjoy this, please leave a review. It really helps other people find us. And I will catch you guys next time.